Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to Mountain Comics. I am your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin this month is our pal, Dr. Chris Lewis. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rob. I'm really pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me to Mount Fire and Water. But the 6-hour flight was a bit of a killer, to be honest, especially because you guys didn't spring for a flight that actually stopped at an airport. So I had to pull a DB Cooper, and I've only just got the pine needles out of my backside. So thanks for that.
Johanna Stewart is a note. I have to jump out of the plane to do a podcast right now and just open the door. No, I'm very thrilled to have you here. It's always a joy to talk to you, no matter what the subject matter, whether it's Bob Dylan or comic books or MASH or whatever it is. It is always fun. And so I'm glad we finally got to get you on not only Mountain Comics, but the season finale of Mountain Comics. This is the final episode. Wow. For this season, yes, because, I mean, obviously, by the time everybody's hearing this, it's November, so winter not officially here, but the season is wrapping up, and so I thought for this final episode of the season, we would do something a little different, and everyone, you've already seen the show notes, we're going to be talking about two different comics, both of who are from the same series, Green Lantern, but one of them is a Chris Lewis vacation comic. So I thought that would be really fun. And when I realized that I had a Green Lantern, you pitched this to me. And then I realized I had a Green Lantern on my Mountain Comics to-do list. So I thought, well, this is perfect. We'll talk about two issues of the same series at different points in the run. And they're both our Mountain Comics or vacation comics. So before we get to the synopses, Chris, tell us a little bit, like, this is your version of a Mountain Comic, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I told you a little bit about my sort of comics origin history on For All Mankind, but basically my access to American comics in particular, and my parents weren't big on comics generally. They were very big on reading. We read voraciously, but they thought comics were a bit lowbrow. And American
they're not wrong.
They're not wrong. But you know, American comics were like gold dust. There was nowhere that I knew near me that sold them, and so really the only reliable place that we could get American comics, and I, from my memory, I think it really only was DC. I don't remember seeing any Marvel. Was when we went to travel to see my grandparents, who lived up near Birmingham. So we lived just south of London, and they lived up in the Midlands. And we would stop about halfway at a truck stop near Oxford. And they had a little newsagent, so really little newsagents. And they stocked, you know, chewing gum and chocolate bars and the kind of magazines that, you know, single gentlemen who were doing a lot of traveling in lorries probably liked to buy. But down on the bottom shelf, there were, for some reason, a selection of probably quite outdated DC comics. And so we would snap these up because we were on holiday. You know, things were a little looser, and my parents allowed us to buy a comic, partly, I suspect, to shut us up in the back of the car for the next half hour. And I would try and get Green Lantern, and my brother would usually try and get The Flash. And so we would spend the next kind of 10, 15 minutes reading our own, and then we'd swap and we'd read the other ones. And and so it was, that was kind of the thing. So my version of Mountain Comics is Truck Stop on the M40 comics, which I think is a little more prosaic and a little less romantic than Mountain Comics. But that, hey, we, them's the breaks. That's where you got to deal. So so this was, I thought this comic we are talking, my pick is 175.
Green Lantern, I thought 175.
This, yeah. I thought this was the first comic DC comic I ever had. But in reading this and researching on the DC Universe app thingy, I thought it would be real interesting to see where this started, what else this team did. And actually, I went back to the first Len Wein and Dave Gibbons, and I recognized it. And the more I read, I thought, no, this definitely was it. So actually, I think I had 172, I think, which was where Hal Jordan comes back from exile and pleads his case to the Guardians. And I recognize that. So my entire comic book history is based on a lie, Rob. It's based on a lie. I've only just discovered this.
We find that that's often the case when you're thinking of childhood, you know, like you have memories that are so certain, and then they slam up against what really happened. You know, you're like, wait, that's not a thing. That's not what it was. So
in fairness, a lot's happened since 1984, you know?
Yes, so. It's been a long time.
I have been to a Comic-Con and met Dave Gibbons and got him to sign my Absolute Watchmen. In fact, I hear that in the UK, there are a few rare examples of Absolute Watchmen, which actually aren't signed by Dave Gibbons. But what I should have done is taken Green Lantern 175, because I bet he doesn't sign a lot of them. And it would have been good to have him leaf through and sort of see through it, because this is not that far from when Watchmen started. This was April 84. So it's not that far from when he would have started drawing Watchmen, I think.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That was 85. So, and this, where his work on Green Lantern helped him certainly get noticed. Mm-hmm. He was obviously a British comic star. Before we get to Green Lantern, though, I do want to inquire a little bit about this truck stop on the M4 thing. So did they
really?
I find this stuff fascinating. I love stories of how people interact with comics. I mean, I say it virtually every episode of this show and other shows, is that I think we've genuinely lost something, that comic books are not accessible by regular people anymore, that you have to go to a specialty shop to get them, that you, mm-hmm. a kid like mm-hmm. you and your brother, you're never going to stumble on comic books now. Kids your age are not going to, I mean, I know, you know, they've got their iPads and their, you know, I realize that it's a little bit different, but still, you're never going to just discover comics anymore. You have to go and search them out, and that changes the equation a little. So in this store, did they also have British comics, or did they just have this little weird selection of DCs that they somehow got?
Yeah, I guess there might have been a few. I mean, honestly, Rob, it was a long time ago. I mean, I guess there must have been, because they just would have been so much more available through the regular kind of channels. I think that the question is, why the heck did this tiny little place have DC comics? I mean, you know, there's that story, isn't it? And I don't know how true this is, that, you know, old DC comics were basically used as ballast in your cargo ships. Yep. You know, I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, somebody somewhere must have kind of picked these things up. And I guess if they were considered ballast, there was nothing valuable, you know, to them. But so somebody maybe picked them up and thought, yeah, if I can get these for a couple of pennies and I can sell them on to, you know, kids that pass through, that's great. But I mean, I think you're right. You know, how did I know Green Lantern? Well, it was kind of from my very limited exposure to Super Friends. And I kind of latched on to Green Lantern, as, you know, that was the later series, wasn't it? The Green Lantern appeared in Super Friends cartoon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I must have latched on at some point and just kind of gone, that's the thing. The only other kind of American superhero cartoons, I think there was a Filmation Fantastic Four. So that's my only kind of Marvel kind of touch point was that. But Super Friends sort of lodged a little bit deeper, I think. And you're right. You know, where would you go if you wanted this stuff? I mean, you know, there are still kind of reprint, kind of comics on the supermarket shelves these days, but it's not American superheroes. I think, and the British comic market has kind of imploded pretty badly. You know, there were all sorts of titles when I was a boy. There was sort of Wizard and Chips and Core and Tiger and all those kind of
Beano, was that one of them? That was a long running one, right?
Beano and Dandy are kind of the great survivors, really. They were kind of the biggest ones and the great survivors. But, you know, there were loads of other ones. There was, you know, sort of soccer-based comics and war-based comics and other kind of humor-based comics that were out at that sort of time, the 70s and the 80s. But I'm sure if Martin Gray is listening, I'm sure Martin will give you chapter and verse on this. But you know, but they seem to have disappeared. More's the pity, really, because there was quite a wide variety. But yeah, Beano and Dandy, I think, have kind of just about hung on in there. But I don't know what model they use. I mean, I guess there must be some off-the-shelf stuff, but whether they do more subscription stuff, and you know, kids these days and their iPads, what do you know? I'm sure they do a kind of beam it to your iPad thing.
Probably. So, okay, one last
but
thing.
But I'm an old man.
one last thing about this truck stop on the M4, which I'm going to say in its complete name. How far away from that place do you live now? Is that close or is that pretty far away?
Oh, 90 miles.
Okay, because what I'm kind of getting at is, I wonder if it's still there.
Oh, the service station is still there.
Oh, it's still there. Okay.
Yeah. It was quite an impressive one, actually. It had sort of fountains outside. I remember vividly. It was sort of 50-50 whether they actually worked or not, but they did. So it was quite an impressive kind of place. But yeah, it's still there. But whether the tiny little newsagents selling, you know, DC Comics is still there, I would put money on it not being.
No, I'm surely not. I just the other day I was in we have these dollar stores here, which I don't know if they have them anymore. It's just everything is a dollar. That's the, you know.
Yeah, we don't use the dollar, Rob. I hate to.
Well, I think you could transpose what I was trying to say. Smart ass. I'm talking about it. These are stores where every item is the same price, and you know what the price is. That's what they have. But I wasn't looking for it, but I happened to walk by like kind of the book magazine section, and this dollar store had a fairly generous selection of Avengers puzzle books, like, you know, word finds and stuff for, and I thought to myself, but they don't have the comics. Like, they have the characters in puzzle books. But not the, you know, the comics are just, no, forget it. But yet the characters are important enough to be branded onto other things. Yeah. It just makes me kind of go, all right. But it's sad.
The kids buying the puzzle books know that they're movie stars. So, you know.
Right, exactly. They probably don't even know that there are comic book stars, probably. Yeah. So let's talk about Green Lantern number 175. So take it away, Chris.
Should we start with the cover?
Sure.
It's the creative team, as we said, is Len Wein and Dave Gibbons. And boy, for one of my first American comics, did I land on my feet there, because I don't think that is a creative team that has many rivals, frankly. The cover is the classic Green Lantern logo. We have in red the title blurb, the cover blurb says shark bait, and I love how the A has been turned into the fin of the shark and the K is like the tail fins. Very clever. And it also says gloriously guest starring The Flash. And the image is of the shark fighting Hal Jordan, Green Lantern. He's half, the shark is half in, half out of the water, but Hal is fully submerged and there's a torrent of bubbles coming from his panicked face. And I love this cover. I think it's colorful. I think it's bright. And Rob, you can speak to the design better than I can, but I love how your eye is drawn in a spiral around this cover. You kind of go from the shark bait down around the shark's kind of fist, down the bubbles to Hal's drowning face, around his arm, up the back of the shark, and down then to his kind of maw of razor sharp teeth. Dave Gibbons is just killing it on this cover. What do you think of it, Rob?
Yes, it's a masterful image. I mean, look, we're not breaking any new ground here saying Dave Gibbons pretty good, you know. I mean, like, okay, sure. But this is an absolutely fantastic cover. As you say, it's beautifully designed and executed and colored, and I saw this. I mean, I've seen this cover at some point on Mike's Amazing World here and there, but this was really the first opportunity I've had to look at it in sort of detail. And yeah, it's fantastic. And you mentioned about you loved Green Lantern and your brother loved the Flash. Well, here you go. This is exactly what you guys were going to buy, because it's got the logo on the cover. It's a gorgeous image. Absolutely fantastic. Well,
I'll come back to that, Rob, in a bit, because I think that was one of the reasons why I sort of fell in love with comics at this point. But I'm going to go into a synopsis, and Rob, you will back me up on this, because this is an incredibly dense Bronze Age comic with at least four plot threads. So forgive me for the length of this summary. Our opening splash page, is a fist pounding angrily down on a newspaper on a desk. The headline proclaims GL saves LA. And there's a photo of Green Lantern flying across the sky. And the text boxes set up the theme of the narrative device of this comic, which is the newspaper. And this is the thread on which the various plots are hung in this issue, from the very first to the very last panel. So here, the paper is bringing someone the unwelcome news of GL's success, and that someone is Congressman Jason Block. In a very Basil exposition way, we, the readers, figure out that he's a super rich, super paranoid politician with a complete power complex. Thank God we've moved on from those guys. Am I right?
Oh, Lynn Wein.
Am I right? Oh, God. So Block has got a grudge against the Emerald Ringslinger. And Jason isn't the kind of guy to keep his guessing wife along. He shouts at his late father's spirit how he hired the Javelin to steal a solar engine from Ferris Aircraft and use it to fire a rocket bomb at LA, something that Hal stopped back in last issue, hence the newspaper headlines. He's in mid-rant when a mysterious man enters the congressman's office. He hesitantly introduces himself as Mr. Smith. I don't think that that's his real name. And he comes across as a kind of proto-Maxwell Lord. Smith tells Block to lay off Ferris Aircraft, but Block tells us that his grudge comes from his belief that Carl Ferris, that's Carol's father, killed his father, Conrad Block. The congressman sends Smith away with a flea in his ear and turns to a wall safe from which he pulls a secret file about Hal Jordan / Green Lantern. Block obviously knows Hal's secret identity, but how that's going to play out remains to be seen. Elsewhere, Hal is having breakfast with Carol, and it looks like he stayed the night. He's reading his own newspaper headline, but it's a smaller story that catches his eye. His buddy the Flash is in legal trouble. Yes, it's the start of the 17 and a half year long epic, The Trial of Barry Allen, in which Barry stands accused of killing Reverse Flash and his own book sales figures. Hal kicks himself for being in exile off world for the last year, missing all the trial fun. So he suits up and he flies away. Elsewhere, in an alleyway, a homeless man is using the newspaper to stuff the holes in his leaking shoes. It's the last thing he ever does because the villainous shark looms in the alleyway and sucks out the man's mind. Elsewhere, the Flash is taking a break from his interminable trial proceedings by fighting fan favorite character, the Rainbow Raider. He gets an assist from Hal, and as the police cart off the colorful villain, the two heroes retire to the top of a tower block to commiserate about Barry's legal woes. Hal decides against using the ring to probe Barry's mind for his true motive because apparently easing your best friend's mental anguish is somehow against a kind of guardian code or something. Elsewhere, a Star Labs trio of scientists who specialize in that popular scientific field of meddling in stuff you really don't understand are reading the newspaper story of Green Lantern's previous exploits. Inspired by his heroism, they are eager to try out their experimental psi chair. Leader Dr. Clay Kendall straps himself into the psionic device to try and make a paper plane fly by force of will alone, but instead his mind touches the ravenous mind of the shark. Idiots! Elsewhere, the shark spots the newspaper and ignores the piece about Green Lantern. His attention is drawn to an article about Star Labs, who he blames for the bizarre and unnatural hyper-evolution. He decapitates a fire hydrant and uses the fountain of water to fly through the air, bursting into the lab building and sucks out the mind of a security guard before taking the rest of the lab staff hostage. Green Lantern doesn't hear the screams, but he does notice a SWAT team heading to the lab. He arrives on scene and a police officer tells him that the shark is inside, and GL reminisces about how the shark is an old foe and has faced off against the likes of Superman, Aquaman, Wonder Woman and the JLA before this point. Then there's a big old fight. Apparently, the Green Lantern ring can't harm the shark directly because he has an invisible yellow force field. Can something invisible have a color? Yada, yada, comic book physics, whatever. Anywho, the shark is able to beam some frightening images into Hal's brain. But because Green Lantern entry criteria number one is fearless, or at least able to overcome fear, it fails. But it does give Hal an idea, and he conjures up a ring construct of the only creature that sharks are instinctively afraid of, a dolphin. It works. Hal gets the terrified shark down on the sidewalk and is about to finish him off when Oh, the irony. A gust of wind blows one of those bloody newspapers into Hal's face. The advantage is lost. The tide is turned. Did you see what I did there? And the shark grabs Hal's face and sucks out his mind. You can tell because his pupils disappear from his eyes. The onlooking crowd are enraged that their hero has fallen, and the SWAT team turn their firepower on the beast, but it's some sort of mental attack that halts the shark in his potential feeding frenzy. He summons a geyser from a subterranean water main and flies slash jumps slash swims off to safety, vowing to return. Meanwhile, the stricken figure of Green Lantern lies on the sidewalk, draped in a copy of that fateful newspaper. As the final narration box puts it, to most, it is merely a newspaper, but to one, it is more like a shroud. And that is why I love DC Comics.
First of all, thank you for that synopsis. I mean, you really gave us our money's worth. But that, I mean, it's mostly due to Len Wein, because you're just transposing what he wrote. But nevertheless, that was a brilliantly executed synopsis of a single issue of Green Lantern.
It is. The writing is just gloriously over the top. I mean, it takes itself so damn seriously, and it's melodramatic, and it's just great. I love it. I think it's a great example of, you know, there's so many plot threads, there's so much going on, there's so many things from previous issues. And that old sort of maxim of every issue is somebody's first. This genuinely was my first issue of not just this comic, but any American comic, pretty much.
Wow.
And I think that it's so clever to have that. He's gone, how do I explain all of the plot going on? And to use this thread of the newspaper all the way through, it is a bit overblown, it is a bit overdone, but it works really well. And he finds really different things to do with that newspaper that brings him into the next scene. I think it's a masterclass in comic book writing. For all its slightly purplish prose, I just love it. And it was so addictive to me. And that's, you know, that's why we're here talking now, is that this comic just, you know, lodged in my brain and said, this is just a lot of fun.
Much like the shark, he's lodged itself in people's brains. Yeah. This is what this comic did for you.
Yeah.
This is an absolutely marvelous book to be the first comic book a kid's going to read. I mean, it's got, as you said, it's got all the purple praise. Len Wein obviously took his cues from Stan Lee, as all those guys from that generation did, but then brought his own, you know, his own talent and his own, you know, skill set to it. Look, I'll say this. Of all the core members of the Justice League, as we know, this is my favorite comic growing up. Green Lantern was always my least favorite. And so therefore, I just never, Hal Jordan was always just like, all right. You know, I didn't dislike Green Lantern, but I just was interested the least. He was interesting, the least interesting to me of all of them. And so consequently, his solo stories are the ones I have read the least. I read Batman for about 10 straight years. I read Superman, certainly Aquaman. I would read Wonder Woman and Flash for long stretches. But most of the Green Lantern solo book, I have not read. So I never read. I did not read this comic until you selected it for this episode. And I read it and I absolutely loved it. And I knew Dave Gibbons had a run on Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. I had read one or two here and there over the years. And again, we're not saying anything revelatory by saying Dave Gibbons is brilliant, but he absolutely crushes the art on this. Part of it, I think it helps that he's also the letterer. So like Jim Aparo, he's working with himself about where to put in the water balloons and the sound effects.
I was going to say, this is a three-man comic. Len Wein is the writer and editor.
Yep.
That's got to help. Yep. Dave Gibbons is the artist and letterer. And then you just have Anthony Tolin as colorist.
Yep.
I mean, that's an amazing feat, isn't it? Just to turn out a book, one solitary book. I mean, I don't know how long they had a run where they just had three of them on the team, but man alive, it's spectacular.
Yeah. I mean, open a comic nowadays, you'll see there's 17 people in the credit box. You know, you're just like, good Lord. I mean, now, aside from just old man shakes his fist at cloud, like, how does any given comic book make money when you got to pay that many people to do it? Here, you got three people. That's it. You got three people.
Hopefully you're paying at least some of them time and a half.
Hopefully. I mean, look, Gibbons got double the pay. It wasn't like they were saving money because Gibbons got paid as an inker and a penciler and a letterer. And he certainly deserved it. But nevertheless, it just in these days where you're literally shipping pages, you know, in envelopes, and in this case, overseas to Dave Gibbons, you're just saving so much time because it's like Ween sends Gibbons the script. Gibbons finishes the book essentially and then sends it to Tolan to color. And you're like,
hands it off to the colorist. Yeah. Fantastic.
I love Gibbons's motif with the JGL Saves LA panel across four different pages. And we're seeing four different people as they're seeing it. The shark is one of those villains that is so goofy that if drawn by the wrong person, it's just absurd. But when drawn by somebody of Gibbons's talent, it's terrifying. Imagine how scary it would be if you saw a muscly guy walking around with a shark head. It would be really, really scary. And he makes the shark genuinely terrifying here.
Yeah. So my question to you, Rob, is why is the shark not a major Aquaman villain? I mean,
I don't know. He should be.
Shouldn't he?
Yes. He absolutely should be. And the part of the thing is that when you, if you don't know the shark, right, and you just see him, like his listing in Who's Who, you think he's an Aquaman villain. You're like, well, what other hero would he be fighting? And then you realize, oh, he has all these mental powers, which doesn't really fit with his visual motif that you would just think.
His powers that he swings around and he really fights people. He's super strong. He's obviously got a shark's mouth full of teeth, but he's got mental powers. He can somehow conjure up water jets. He's got this very nonsensical, invisible / yellow force field, which nobody can actually see because he's not all yellow all the time. But hey, you know, comic books, you need that. But his power set is really, really bizarre. But he could so easily fit into an Aquaman comic. And I've no idea. I mean, there's King Shark, isn't there?
The Suicide Squad.
He was in the Aquaman book that was the not Arthur Curry, the 1 year later.
Oh, sort of.
Buziak. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of Atlantis. Atlantis.
Yeah. He was in that. But so I'm not quite sure why the shark has fallen out of favor. Because he just feels like a real threat. And I could absolutely see him going toe-to-toe with Aquaman. I'd love, because, you know, they've both got mental powers. They're both under sea, you know. It is bizarre to me that he's not an Aquaman villain.
Think of the inherent terror of being in the water and having a shark chasing you. And you're like, well, the one thing I have is that once I get on land, I'm safe. And then the shark can just climb onto the beach and chase after you. How really terrifying that would be. Yeah. And Gibbons, there's a couple of panels here, and we'll have some pages from this comic on the gallery post. The one where he's grabbing the homeless guy, grabs his face, and then he grabs the other guy, and he's like that. I mean, it's genuinely scary. Again, as goofy as the shark is, because he's got a uniform on, it's just it is so well done. I love when he jumps out the building and pushes and they fall down the side of the building as Green Lantern is tackling him. And the use of the serprints by Gibbons is absolutely fantastic. I mean, he was no wonder he got the Watchmen assignment. I mean, part of it was, I'm sure, he was a British artist and he had a relationship with Moore already, but this is just, you look at this comic and you say, yeah, this guy's going to be an all-star because this work is just so far beyond what most people are doing in superhero comics at the time.
Yeah. The whole thing is structured and drawn so beautifully. I mean, it's a really bold move to open the story with what is actually the least consequential bit of the book, which is this whole congressman subplot, which I still don't quite understand. We then move on to Hal and Carol in their flat. And just the way that you were drawn, I think I just heard the podcast you and Noah Tarnow did about Seraph and saying that he and his girlfriend just look like a couple. Mm-hmm. And you can tell the way that Hal and Carol in this apartment, you know, they are clearly a couple. They are clearly deeply in love. They're very affectionate. They've been making up for lost time because he's been off world for a year. You know, you just know that. There's nothing said about that, but you just know it from the way that they interact. And that's partly this sort of slightly flirty, bantery dialogue, but just the way Gibbons draws them is terrific. You know, then we've got the comedy beat of the Flash and the Rainbow Raider, you know, which is, you know, he does a whole Flash story in three, four pages.
Right.
I was going to come back to that because I said my brother bought the Flash and this crossed over into the Flash book. So in the Flash book, you had this little scene where he's chasing the Raider and he bumps into Hal and they have this conversation and then they go their separate ways. That is told in the Flash book. From Barry's perspective.
Oh, is it and really? Think, that's marvelous. That's great.
That, for me, just in my brain, just went, oh my God, this is a universe. You know, they talk to one another, they cross over. And that, to me, suddenly went, oh, these things connect. And I think that, for me, was one of the big draws to this, to kind of go, oh, you can be in that book, and actually they touch and they move away again, and it's all the seamless story. And that was a huge appeal for me as a kid to go, oh, okay, these characters, it's not just this book and this book and this book. This is a connected place. And they all into, and that was a transformational moment for me reading comics. And I still love that about comics when they reference one another. And of course, these books all have these fantastic old, you know, editor's notes where, you know, he's reminiscing about where the shark fought Superman and the shark fought Wonder Woman. And all the references are linked. And so for the first time, I've been able to go back in the app and kind of dig out Action 456 and Adventure 448 and look at those kind of old, you know, those previous confrontations with the shark and go, yeah, this guy has a, you know, the shark has a history going through the DC line as well. So impressive to me as a young reader.
It's a little bonus for me that I got to see Dave Gibbons draw Aquaman. If it's even just for that one panel, but that didn't happen a lot, you know, it did not happen very much. I didn't know that they classic crossover with the Flash comic. That's great. I love that. It's a wonderful detail to coordinate with that creative team and do this little inset. I love the sound, the one panel that's just the sound effect where the Rainbow Raider gets smushed in between two giant stop signs and it just clang. And Gibbons draws his hand just poking out from the two stop signs. And that's a great detail. Gibbons was masterful at body language. You mentioned the Carol Ferris and Hal Jordan scene. Like, she tousles his hair.
Yeah.
As she's putting down the coffee. That's a great little detail. And then when Green Lantern and Flash run into each other and he puts his hands on Barry's shoulder. You know, like that's a great lady. And that's a friendship thing. I want to now read this whole run of Ween and Gibbons on Green Lantern, because this is a gap in my superhero comic reading of the 80s. I could only buy so many books. And this was just Green Lantern was just the Guardians of the Universe. I was always like, I don't know. These guys, I don't know. It just didn't track with me. And so I skipped Green Lantern for most of its run. But man, I was like, I'm really missing something here, because this comic was just fantastic. I was like, I want to, and I don't want to buy a collected edition. I want to just buy the print comics and read them.
Single editions. Yeah. That's sort of really amazing, because obviously you were far more of an artistic kid than I was, because in some ways, the Green Lantern power is the most artistic of the powers. And they sort of embrace that with Kyle saying he's an artist and he brings that to his thing. But, you know, Dave Gibbons, you know, the drawing of the dolphin.
It's great.
I mean, I know artists kind of go, oh, we don't want to draw horses and cars. But I don't know how easy an actual dolphin. And that panel, how running towards the dolphin, arching over the shark who's cowering in fear. Beautiful stuff. And so, you know, I would have thought, you know, for the chance to draw absolutely anything, you know, I mean, Green Lantern's Aladdin, isn't he? Power, you know, magic ring, magic lamp, it's Aladdin. But the imagination you've got to say, you can draw anything. The one I look back to that I kind of realized I must have had bought for me a few months before has Hal flying through space and through a meteor storm and then realizing he's got to stop the meteors hitting a planet. And he He conjures up a ring image of a pair of hands and a pool cue, and he plays pool with the meteorites in the middle of space. And it, and Gibbons draws all the bouncing meteorites pinging off one another and, you know, destroying each other. And it's just so much fun. And that's what Green Lantern is to me. It's that sort of I know the boxing glove and the mallet. Okay, fine, whatever. But right. You can actually do anything with the ring. You can make anything. And I know that different writers have had different Green Lanterns take a different approach to that. So I'm not quite up to speed where John Stewart is, but when he was in his architect phase, his ring constructs were like architect drawings. You know, they were kind of, you know, they had the angles and they had all the different moving parts and they kind of came together in that slightly more mechanical kind of way. Kyle Rayner was into kind of manga-esque kind of robots and kaiju and stuff like that. So that's what his construct's like. You know, I think you can take these, the concept of Green Lantern and say, you know, you're the character who is Green Lantern can have their constructs be a reflection of their personality and their skill and their talent. And I love that about Green Lantern. I think when that's played well, you know, it's just a really nice little nuance to the character.
Yeah, this was a total winner. I was so pleasantly surprised. I mean, I knew it was going to be pretty good. It's Lynn Wein and Dave Gibbons. I wasn't expecting anything. You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I wasn't like, oh, this is not going to be these two, you know, whatever. But I just hadn't read these. I just hadn't read them, you know? Yeah. And I just... You know, the 80s, 70s and 80s, really the 80s, is my sweet spot for superhero comics. It's when I was buying the most amount of comics. I was keeping track of the most amount of series. I was going to the comic shop every single week, the day the books came out, following every story because it all mattered to me. And this was just a big blind spot. And as I get older and I go back and I read lots of old comics, I tend to think, oh, there's no real... Again, we're talking about mainstream superhero comics. I don't want to say all comics, obviously. But for mainstream superhero comics, I thought, well, there's really nothing that new for me to discover. I'm familiar with the John Byrne FF. I'm familiar with Wonder Woman. I'm familiar, you know, like all the main titles. I had some idea of what was going on. But this was all new to me. And I thank you so much for buying this comic when you were a small kid so we could talk about it now, because I want to read the rest of these Wein Gibbons GLs. It was just great. Yeah.
Well, do you know, I mean, me too, because I think, you know, it was reading this one that made me go, I should really go back and find out, you know, where this started. And again, you know, after many, many, many years of comic buying in the 90s and 2000s, it kind of went, oh yeah, this must have come from somewhere. And that made me go back and go, oh, yeah, actually, I have now read the story with the javelin. And, you know, I'll now go on and read the, you know, spoiler alert. The next issue is a sort of slightly metaphysical one, because actually Green Lantern isn't dead. I know that comes as a shock to everybody listening, but he's actually transported into the mind of the shark. So it's sort of a sort of psychic kind of thing. I think they're great. I think they're just super fun.
So do you remember continuing to buy the series after this, right?
No, not after this, because again, you know, we just didn't have access to it. So it was a kind of, you know, we didn't go and see my grandparents that often, you know, a couple of times a year. I really started buying Green Lantern when I went to university in the 90s. Okay. And that was the 90s reboot after Emerald Dawn. And it was drawn by M.D. Bright, and it was sort of this old book that sort of flipped between, had a kind of opening story which featured Hal but then brought John Stewart and Guy in, and then they sort of did alternate runs of Guy and then John, and then that branched into the Mosaic book and Green Lantern Quarterly, and I just kept reading from there.
Gotcha. Okay. Wow, man, yeah, that's awesome. Great book. That was just so much fun.
I'm so pleased you liked it.
Oh, man. And I can only imagine, again, what you and your brother, you being young children, that's just, it's the perfect, it's like a perfect comic. And it's a complete story. That's something, too. It's got continued stories, obviously, but it has a beginning, middle, and end, which is, I think, you know, you feel like you're getting a full meal for your, in my case, 75 cents and in your parlance, what would be 60p or whatever it was, whatever, something like that. But yeah, you're getting a, you know, you feel like you're getting a full magazine. So that's so good. So by the fact I mentioned that, you know, Mount Green Lantern number 194, which was on sale August 15th, 1985, which means I would have been one day away from turning 14, made me say, well, wait a minute, because I remembered I did start buying Green Lantern and I actually kept going with it until the book, when it got morphed into Green Lantern Corps, and then it eventually got canceled. So I'm kind of looking back at Mike's Amazing World and seeing, where did I start buying Green Lantern? Because obviously I did. And I see that I started picking it up with issue number 189, which by that point, Englehart and Joe Staton had taken over. And I love Joe Staton. But I am kind of curious, like, why did I just skip all the Ween Gibbons stuff? I don't know. I missed it entirely. Why did I? What was it about Green Lantern 189 that made me start reading it? But I did, because that's where I started picking it up. So I don't know.
Okay. So this was not one that you just, because you were in the Poconos and you just had to read something, anything, it doesn't matter. God damn it, Green Lantern. Okay, I'll buy Green Lantern.
Yeah, no, by this point, I was already, really reading Green Lantern. Yeah, I was already on board. So with the fact that it was on sale in the mountains, I was like, oh, okay, I'll just, I want to read this. So the one we're talking about, as I mentioned, it's Green Lantern 194. The story is called Five. It's by, as I mentioned, Steve Englehart, Joe Staton, and Bruce Patterson. So my synopsis will be a little briefer. While helping prevent natural disasters in Star City, Green Lantern John Stewart meets the being known as Harbinger, who wants to recruit John as an agent of the Monitor. Stewart initially regards her as a threat, and a fight breaks out, also involving Katma Twi, Green Arrow, and Black Canary. Ultimately, though, Stewart comes to believe her. At the Monitor satellite, John Stewart meets up with other heroes enlisted in the cause when shadow demons attack. Katma Twi sends a message to the Guardians of the Universe to tell them of the looming threat. They plan to call in the entire Corps, but before they can, the Anti-Monitor attacks, killing many of the Guardians. Looking for help, Twi goes to find the recently retired Hal Jordan. Hal, after a long bout of depression, decides to turn his life around and return to the Corps, but not before visiting the grave of Abin Sur. Also there is Guy Gardner, and the two argue. Suddenly, a Guardian arrives and announces that they are admitting a new member into the Corps, Guy Gardner. The two vanish to Oa, leaving Hal behind. All right, so let's talk about this cover, Chris. What do you think of this this cover image here?
Well, you can tell it's a crisis crossover because the sky is red, for starters. So it's Katma Twi and John Stewart joining forces against Harbinger, and in the background is a sort of slightly faded out Monitor. I'm not sure if that's technically a surprint or quite what it is, but yeah, I mean, it's pretty dramatic. It's a good, unlike the previous one, it's actually not a bad representation of what's actually in the comic, for starters. Great Green Lantern. I mean, it's the classic logo. Yeah, it's good, it's fine. And yeah, forget it, Harbinger, you're not taking us anywhere. Well, that's true, because she only takes John Stewart, kidnaps John Stewart.
It's this cover, though, is kind of reflective of what you were just talking about, that, like, obviously we see that John Stewart and Katma Twi don't have a lot of imagination, because it's just beams. They're not doing anything clever with their with their power rings. They're just kind of hitting her with a beam. You know, it's funny. I rereading this comic, it's been decades since I read it. When I was a kid, I loved the Crisis crossovers, because it was like you were just talking about with Flash. It was all one interconnected universe, and the Crisis was so exciting, and it was so neat that the book was the Crisis was spilling into every book that I read. It was like so cool. Like, oh, how are they all going to piece this together? Reading it now, and I'm more dubious about the Crisis than I was then. You could sort of see which writers were enthusiastic, or at least could fake it, about getting the Crisis involved in their ongoing storylines, and which writers were like, all right, I'll do it. You know, like Alan Moore, you know, he kind of dragged the Crisis was dragged kicking and screaming. Let me reverse that. Swamp Thing was dragged kicking and screaming into the Crisis. You know, obviously Green Lantern with the setup, of course, and being, you know, a space character fits in much more, much better in the Crisis in general. Yeah. But it is sort of funny just to see how these writers kind of had to be like, oh yeah, all right, for one or two issues, we got to turn over our book to this ongoing thing, you know?
I did wonder how much was, this is a sort of, maybe this is a modern concept, but maybe it's not, how much of Green Lantern's involvement was editorially mandated, because it's not long since Hal has, between the two books, has quit being Green Lantern of Earth, and they have promoted John Stewart. So he was quite a new character, and I wonder if they kind of went, we got to get the new Green Lantern in here, because they're very specific about him being involved, aren't they?
Yep. Yeah. I love the opening where with Green Arrow and Black Canary rescuing people. That's a great sequence. I mean, I love Green Arrow and I love Joe Staten. I mean, we're going waxing Dave Gibbons's car. I love Joe Staten. I've always loved Joe Staten, and Bruce Patterson is a really good anchor for him. So I'm happy about that. I'm just happy to see, you know, Green Arrow in any comic. And of course he has a long history with the Green Lantern title, so I'm happy to see him here. Harbinger, just a drip of a character. I mean, it just, unfortunately, she is. And so when she shows up, I'm just kind of like,
here we are, we're in the crisis.
I think my
familiarity with Joe Staten's a bit later from that sort of 90s Green Lantern series, and I think this is really good Staten. I think he's a little looser in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I think he's a little bit more cartoony. Yes. His John Stewart is looking great. He's a leaner, he's a younger looking John Stewart. I think the art in this is just lovely. Really good. Very different to Dave Gibbons, but really great. Love this Joe Staten art.
Yeah, the sequence where he's walking in the rain, you know, and Tom shows up and picks him up, and that looks fantastic. It's very moody and stuff like that. By the way, before I even jump to that, the sequence where Harbinger is like, you know, I want you, John Stewart, and he tearfully hugs Captain Matui goodbye. I haven't read every single Crisis crossover comic. I've read most of them, but not every single one. And I have to wonder, was there any writer that threw in a gag where if you have a collection of superheroes and Harbinger showed up to pluck one of them out, that the other heroes were like, hey, what am I, chop liver over here? Like, you know, I can fight the shadow demons. Why am I? You know, that would be funny if you had one hero just kind of like, all right, well, screw you, Monitor. I'll just stay here on Earth and do important work.
I'll just die here on the doomed Earth. Thanks for nothing.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
There's one slightly odd bit. There's they make him put his mask back on.
That was weird.
That was weird. And because there's a big thing in the previous books where John Stewart says, no, I am not going to be masked. And then they make him put it back on very specifically and for no terribly good reason. And I just thought, oh, does that mean that half of Crisis was already drawn and they'd put a mask on him?
Is that what? And I guess maybe.
I don't know.
What
I'm guessing. Yeah. And they just kind of went, oh, somebody's picked up that they were, you know, the book took a little bit of a turn since the Crisis planning session, and they made him put it on. And I don't know. Comment below, people, as they say. You know, but it did seem like a very specifically odd thing to make him do when not wearing a mask was such a big thing for John Stewart.
Yeah, I thought so too. Where she's like, oh, when we monitored you, you had a mask. He's like, oh, okay. And then he just beams one on his face. I'm like, okay, all right, that's fine. you know, so then he goes up into the monitor satellite and we get to see Joe Staten draw a bunch of characters that he doesn't get to draw very much. Dawnstar from the Legion and Obsidian and Geo-Force. We do, and the Earth 2 Superman is there. He's drawn Earth 2 Superman before, but that's great. Yeah. I enjoy seeing all those characters together.
What exactly was the monitor's selection criteria? Dr. Polaris, Dawnstar, Geo-Force,
Cyborg.
Cyborg. There's some, you know, deep cuts there, shall we say.
Solovar from the
Simon.
What do we need Solovar for? I mean, no offense to Solovar, but what do we need Solovar for? It's very, very odd. But I enjoyed it. I love the Earth 2 Superman, and like Joe Staten drew him in that fantastic JSA origin story, and he drew him for the JSA Strip and Adventure Comics. So that was fun to see that. So then Cat Matuie takes off and she goes to look for help. And then we're back on the, there's that little interlude. And then we get an appearance by the Monitor. Then there is a group shot of everybody all together, Blue Beetle, Obsidian, as you mentioned, Simon and stuff like that. Just it's kind of funny seeing them all together like that.
Blue Beetle says, "Don't tell my wife." And I don't know that Ted Kord was married in any continuity.
No, I don't think he was. No.
That was a bit of a weird one, unless it was just a gag. But it's a there's some strange little things in here.
Steve Englehart's like, "Look, I write what I want. I'm Steve Englehart. Come on." then,
with 4 months to crisis, who cares?
Yeah, what difference does it make? So then we go to Oa and the Guardians. And this is probably part of the reason I never caught into Green Lantern that much. I don't like the Guardians of Oa. I don't like them. Okay. They're a bunch of drips. They're so self-serious. They seem to be kind of like rule enforcing for its own sake, kind of. They're all very much like, "Harumph, we will study this." And it's like, "Oh, come on, guy." Well, you know, and so, and then they all die like a bunch of bitches at the end where the Anti-Monitor, you know, and there's this panel where like the floor is littered with a bunch of dead Guardians. And it just makes them, it kind of makes them look like the Jedi in Revenge of the Sith. You're like, "Oh, these guys are badass."
Post Anakin. You know. Okay.
Yeah. And then they just all get killed in like 15 minutes. You're like, "Oh, really?" Like,
It does look, there's something, and I assume it's Anti-Monitor in the central battery. It doesn't say specifically, but I'm going to assume Anti-Monitor. There's a bit of a sort of yellowy tinge in the main battery.
Yeah.
So maybe it was a fear thing, but it's not explained. I assume we go on to understand more of it in later issues.
But, it's just, I was just like, "All right, guys, you know, come on." so, you know, and they said, and then Cat Matuie goes to look for help, and then she finds Hal. Hal is in his whole depressive state where he's "I'm sorry, I'm retired."
Did you get kind of It's a Wonderful Life vibes from Hal? He's sort of moping around going, "Oh, you know, everybody else's life is so different without me being Green Lantern." And, you know, Tom Kalmaku's been pottering around in his garage for a couple of months and he's found a way to make the space shuttle boosters burn twice as bright and twice as fast without NASA's, you know, resources. It's all a bit weird and all a bit kind of didn't quite ring true, but it was, I kind of got, he had a sort of George Bailey movement. Good for you. You know, he's obviously very pleased for them, but he's a bit down on himself, isn't he? Sad sack Hal.
Yeah, he is. He is here. And that's a little, like, and that's another reason why I was like, Hal, like, he's quitting. I'm unquitting. I'm like, "All right, come on already." There is a nice little bit where Cat Matuie uses her ring to, you know, jog his memory of when they first met. And then there's these two panels where I don't believe those are reprinted panels. I think that is Joe Staton doing his best Gil Kane / John Broome copy to make it look like what the Green Lantern comic looked like in the 60s. I think that's, I don't think those are reprinted panels. So I think that was a nice little touch on Joe Staton's part to change his style to make it look like what the comic looked like at the time.
It's the most human moment in this whole thing, isn't it? Where Cat Matuie says, "Look, you can always be my friend. You'll always be one of us." She's very sweet. She's very accepting of him, even though he's quit the core. Yeah, it's a really lovely beat in this really quite crazy comic. There's all these different, just like the first one. You know, the first one has all these different plots going on simultaneously. But at least they're in the service of the same storyline. This one is all over the place.
You've
got a bit of Green Lantern and Black Canary. Lovely to see them. And then you've got a bit of John Stewart and Cat Matuie. And then John gets kidnapped and he does his thing. And then Cat Matuie does her thing. And then Hal's being a sad sack. And, you know, it all feels it's full on all the time, but it just feels a bit more scattergun, this one, than the other one. Has a bit more focus, I think.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's subplot. I mean, you know, John Stewart is ostensibly the star of the book at this point, but he kind of, you know, he's sort of the main storyline. But at the same time, you're like, well, but it's eventually going to go back to Hal Jordan because it's Hal Jordan. You kind of know that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, him being kind of a sad sack is like, all right, snap out of it already. You know, come on, get suit up. So then he goes and he visits Abin Sur's grave. And then there's Guy Gardner. And I think that's another reason why I never loved Green Lantern much. I have never liked Guy Gardner. I've just never, I understood he was used to great comic effect in Justice League International, of course, but I've always found him to be just obnoxious. I know, again, I know that's the point, but I just, every time he shows up in a book, I'm just rolling my eyes like, eh, all right, you know? Yeah. So part of the reason why young me was like, nah, I'm the Green Lantern, you know, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, he's a bit of a professional dick, isn't he? Basically, you know, he's, and actually there's something up with him here. I don't, again, I'll have to read on and find out what's going on, but he's very obsessed with getting the power, isn't he? And
yes. It's I want the power. He even says at one point,
he looks very, he hasn't got that kind of weird, JLI haircut. He's sort of got a ginger buzz cut here more. And he's he looks quite thuggish actually in some panels. It's all kind of done in the dark, and he really does look like you know, a bit of a baddie really. But then we get a twist at the end.
Yep. Yeah. The Guardian shows up, and of course Hal's like, oh well, all right, I'm gonna get, and then he takes Guy. He takes Guy with him, and Guy even says, give me power. And the Guardian's like, we shall indeed. And Hal Jordan's like, wait, what? And then that issue ends with Hal just, although I actually, I said in the synopsis that he leaves Hal behind. That is not actually, it's not exactly true, because he jumps into this sort of portal.
Yeah,
and he
it's a little ambiguous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more ambiguous.
It looks
than
like
else.
He disappears. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the continuation. So obviously, I was full on Green Lantern at this point, and I said I continued with the book all until it was canceled. So I enjoyed this comic. It is no Green Lantern 175. I'll tell you that. you know, but I did enjoy it, and it was fun rereading it again for the purposes of the show.
I think the Ween Gibbons morphs into the Engelhart Staten run, so I think what I'm inclined to do is go back and start at the start of the Len Wein run and try and read it through and sort of see how I fare when we hit Crisis proper.
Yeah,
because I think, you know, I mean, this just does feel like one big story, and you know, and I love it for that. I love it that sort of soap opera feel to it. So I'm glad that I've dipped in a little later, because this was new to me, just as 175 was new to you. I'm not sure I love it as much, but I'm intrigued enough to keep reading.
That's all they can ask for, really, at the time. That's all they needed from me. It was like, oh, I like this. Yeah. Oh, I'll keep reading. And you know, that's all they can get out of you at that point is a kind of reading it month to month. So yeah, I am all board. I am all in on Len Wein, Dave Gibbons, Green Lantern. And I don't know. Maybe we'll, after we've had a chance to read them all, like we'll have to do some episode of F2 Presents or something on them. Cause this is, if this one issue is any indication, I'm in for a really bunch of fun reading, you know, and it's, you know, Green Lantern in his prime, it's the DC universe before everything literally blew up, you know, so it's fun stuff. So, but yeah, I remember buying this comic, the 194. I remember reading it up in the mountains, and all the books were involved with the crisis at that point. So, you know, like I said, it didn't age as well as I sort of remembered it, but that's okay. That's totally fine. You know, I mean, it's how these things work out. So that's Mountain Comics, everybody. And that's, what do we call them? Truck Stop Comics for you? Summer Comics?
Please stick with Mountain Comics.
You stick with Mountain Comics? All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well,
do you mind if I ask you, because I have Pocono's questions. So, In my, you know, as we sit here on your metaphorical stoop, you know, my mental image of, you know, your cabin is a log cabin by the lake, and, you know, you're there in your flannel shirt and all the rest of it. But inspired by the cheesy jingle, I looked back and I was slightly disappointed to find that it had been retooled into a casino. And so my entire image of this rural idyll was popped. Was it a resort? Was it an actual cabin that you had?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the Poconos is a very big area. It's a very, very big area. And so the only reason I use that jingle is because we never went near the resort or anything like that. We had a cabin.
Okay.
But the reason I use the jingle is quite literally, it's the only piece of audio I could find that mentions the Poconos in any form. So I was like, close enough, you know, this is as good as I can do. No, people have asked me this before. What we had was there was a lake up there, Lake Wallen Paw Pack. That was the lake. And there was an older couple, and the Cootses with their names, C-O-O-T, or C-O-O-T-S, actually. That was their name. And they owned this chunk of land that sat right on the lake. And it was not wide. It was deep. So like the cabins were stacked basically two in a row for like six rows. And the closer you, there were some further away from the lake. And then there were two cabins literally right on a cliff face overlooking the lake. And our cabin was one of those because my family had been going, my mother had been going there since she was a teenager, and okay. She kept going after she got married to my father. And so the couple that owned this little area, it was called Loch Highlands, was the name of the little section. They gave us sort of first pick of the cabin every year. Cause that was it was cabin two. That was the cabin everybody wanted because it had the best view of the lake. But we always, because we went the same time every year for decades, we always got first. The Cootses were like, it's yours during those 2 weeks of the year, unless you tell us otherwise. And we always went. And so that was always the same place. So yes, you could drive a decent distance and get to this casino and get to the resort, but we didn't go anywhere near that. We were in the much more rural part of the Poconos. So,
okay.
That's what it was. Okay,
you're not popping down to put, you know, all your chips on black or anything.
Yeah. 22, no. two. No. And the Poconos has basically one highway running through it that goes everywhere. If you want to get anywhere, you got to take this one road. You're on it for hours until you get out of the Poconos. And that is where it was dotted with all of these newsstands and supermarkets and drugstores. Mm-hmm. And it was just a matter of hitting these places multiple times a week to get as many comics as I could. And that's how I got the comics. So
where it came from.
That's what it was.
Okay. So, that's lovely. That's restored my faith in the story.
Yeah. Well, it was, I went back about 7 years ago for the first time in a quarter century. And there were some pictures. I posted them on the social media at the time. And it's been built up a lot. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff that I remember is gone. Certainly, those cabins are all still there. I stopped by and there was a lovely couple there, and I walked up and I explained to them, you know, oh, I used to come here as a kid, and they said, oh, come in, take a look. And I took a, you know, in fact, if you go to fireandwaterpodcast.com and you click the hosts tab, which is the little bios of all of us, the picture of me is me in the cabin at age 12 holding my Avengers comic, and then me at age 40 holding the same Avengers comic in front of the same fireplace. Cause I brought the comic with me in case I could get that photo, and I did. So it's the same comic 30 years apart. so all the hair is gone, but it's still me. But yeah. And so my wife and I talk about visiting it sometime because I'd love it to show it to her, but I also know it's all built up, you know. It's almost like, well, what's there kind of to see if everything is all different, you know? All the places I used to buy my comics, there's only two places left that are still there. They don't carry comics anymore, but the buildings are still, well, you're talking about that truck stop, it's still there, you know. It's still there, and it holds some fascination to me of like, wow, I spent so much time in here when I was a child. And you know, the whole notion of like permanence of like, wow, that was 40 years ago at this point, and I'm standing in the same spot that I did, you know, I'm standing here buying this comic. So and obviously these books hold a still mystical hold over me because I'm talking about them, you know, four decades later.
You can never go back, Rob. You can never go
back. No, you cannot. You absolutely cannot. I'm going to try, though, with these Len Wein and Dave Gibbons Green Lanterns.
That
was really good stuff. So, well, Chris, thank you for doing this. I don't know where you are on the Robbie Award. Are we at five with you at this point?
Yeah, I think this is
right.
Five.
Pod Dylan. You've done Pod Dylan. You've done MASHcast. You've done Film and Water. You've done For All Mankind. And now you've done this. So that's five.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I'd like to thank the Academy for this stupendous honor. Wear it with pride. Can you wear a Robbie? Is that the thing?
No, it's a certificate that I will mail to you.
Oh, certificate. Okay.
And all that I ask is that you frame it and put it next to your medical degree. That's all that I ask.
In my office. Okay, that's a deal. I'll send you a photo. How many Robbie alumni do you have now?
You know, that's a really my wife Kelly keeps telling me I should really like make it a thing and really
you need a role of honor then.
Yeah,
like
she
the,
said
like
she
the
said
JLA
that.
She, comics.
Yes,
you need a role
she
of
said
honor.
She goes, she said you should do it at the end of the year. She goes, you should
Headshots,
announce
who. Yeah.
So there's at least a couple. Ange has it. So both doctors have it.
Oh, lovely Ange.
Yeah, Sean Ross has one. I know that. Actually, comic book artist, big time comic book artist Gabriel Hardman. Has five now. At the time we're recording this, he only has four, but by the time you're all hearing this, he'll have five. I'm sure that's his greatest achievement. The man's done storyboards for movies, but I'm sure a Robbie is probably his ultimate artistic achievement.
Obviously.
I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to look and see who else has five at this point. If you're listening to this, somebody, and you have five, let me know. I'm not keeping track of these things, even though I should.
Maybe a separate section on the website, I'm thinking.
Maybe so. Let's take this joke and just beat it into the ground. So anyway, Chris, I thank you so much for pitching this. Were the one who said, hey, I have my own version of a vacation comic. And so I was like, oh, that'll be a fun way to wrap up the season. And it's always a blast talking to you. So thank you so much for coming to the cabin and visiting. I'm guessing you've never had Yoohoo because they probably don't even have it over there, right? You're familiar with that at all?
Were you saying this was a chocolate thing?
It's a chocolate drink. Yeah, it's a watery chocolate drink, which I realize does not sound good, but
boy,
I
you're really
it.
Selling that, ain't you? I managed to smuggle a glass of wine off the aircraft, so I'll stick with that. Thanks.
All right, fair enough. Well, I'm sure there's things we have planned together for the network, so you'll be appearing on the network.
Semi-planned,
but we'll get it done. We'll actually get it done, everybody, and guarantee you'll be back on MASHcast next season. So there's no worries about that. So you'll be here on the network, and you know. By the way, everybody, if you like Chris's appearances, and you should because he's awesome, click the meta tag at the bottom of this episode because he has his own meta tag on the network, and you will find every episode that Chris has been on. Yes. Yes.
Oh my God.
Every guest has one. I mean, it's not super special. We just, but we do it. So in case people that are listening like a particular guest, they can find all the episodes. So just click Chris Lewis's name at the bottom and you'll see all the shows he's been on. So you can check out all the ones he's done across the network. So there you go.
Well, so thank you. I think.
Yeah. No, it's great. No. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Of course, you can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're over on Twitter at FWPMountaincom. You can find all the back episodes on the website, findwaterpodcast.com. If you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, please go to patreon.com/FWPodcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to David S. Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of the Find Water Podcast Network. So as I mentioned, this is the season finale of Mountain Comics. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks to my guests this year, Sean M. Myers, Brett Young, Henry Bernstein, the great Paul Kupperberg, Ward Hill Terry. Thank you all so much for doing the show. It's such a labor of love to do this. It's just pure comics love. And I really enjoy doing it. And luckily, there are lots more Mountain Comics to talk about. So we will be back next year. But anyway, thanks, everybody, for listening. Oh, of course. And if you want to leave a comment, go to findwaterpodcast.com and we'll be reading the comments for this season and the first episode of next season like we normally do. So thanks everybody for listening and we will see you next year. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos.
Every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and
beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.